you know, if you break your arm, the ER doctor takes an x-ray, and there's this jagged white line in the bone. And they just point at the illuminated screen, right?
Yeah, there it is. Undeniable.
Exactly. There it is. It's binary. It's visible. And honestly, it's deeply comforting in a weird way. As human beings, we really want our problems to be easily categorized and externally located.
We want to see the fracture.
Right. We want to point to it. But stepping into the world of spiritual diagnosis, specifically, looking at the very nature of our existence and our chronic dissatisfaction, well, it renders that physical x-ray machine entirely useless.
Oh, completely useless.
Yeah, because we're looking at a diagnostic landscape that is entirely internal. And for most of us, it's completely unexamined. We're walking around with this profound, pervasive sickness, but we just assume the symptoms are normal life.
Right. We normalize the disease. We really do.
We do. We think the low-grade fever of anxiety, the sudden spikes of anger, or, you know, the constant exhausting pursuit of the next pleasurable moment, we think this is just what it means to be human.
Well, today we are stripping away that normalization. We're doing a deep dive into the corrected transcripts from the Bodhi Archive. Specifically, we have a 10-session Easter retreat that took place back in April 1999 at Buddha House in Adelaide.
And the teacher here is Kensura Rinpoche, right?
Exactly. A highly revered lineage master of the Gelug school of Tibetan Buddhism. And we're approaching this material today not just as some casual philosophical overview. This is a profound transmission of Dharma.
Yeah, it's like a manual for the mind.
It really is. So we're unpacking it the way senior practitioners would sit down to study a precious instruction, with a lot of care and a scholarly measured approach.
So our mission today, for you listening, is to systematically walk through Kensura Rinpoche's teachings on the Four Noble Truths, which is really the absolute bedrock, isn't it?
Oh, it's the foundation of everything. This is the very first teaching given by Buddha Shakyamuni at Varanasi, also known as Benares, right after his enlightenment under the Bodhi tree.
Right. And it's the universal foundation accepted by all four Buddhist schools of tenets. It serves as the absolute base for both the lesser and the greater vehicles.
Yeah, Rinpoche emphasizes that without a really firm, unshakable understanding of this specific foundation, progress on the path is just impossible.
You can't cultivate the necessary wisdom. You can't cultivate the method.
And you certainly can't achieve the ultimate results of liberation from cyclic existence, let alone full Buddhahood.
Right. But before Rinpoche actually gets into the nitty-gritty of the truths themselves, he anticipates this crucial skepticism from the audience. He doesn't just say, well, the Buddha said this, therefore it's true.
No. The Gelug tradition places an immense premium on logical reasoning. Blind faith is considered a really unstable foundation. So Rinpoche opens by structuring a rigorous argument for why Shakyamuni Buddha can be trusted with our ultimate well-being.
He establishes him as a trustworthy guide.
Exactly. And this trustworthiness is rooted in a long-term evolutionary developmental process.
Yeah.
I mean, the Buddha didn't just wake up one day with arbitrary spiritual authority.
Right. It wasn't just handed to him.
No. Over countless lifetimes, he developed great love and great compassion. And it was the sheer force of that compassion that drove him to cultivate the wisdom, realizing emptiness.
So by perfecting those two wings, the method of compassion and the wisdom of emptiness, he achieved enlightenment.
Yes. And he taught the Four Noble Truths. First, out of this desperate, compassionate wish to fulfill two aims for sentient beings. Temporary wishes, meaning a higher, more fortunate rebirth, and ultimate wishes, which means definite goodness or complete liberation.
Okay, so to establish this framework, Rinpoche invokes these great Indian masters, Dignaga and Dharmakirti. And these guys are the absolute titans of Buddhist epistemology.
Heavy hitters, yeah.
Right. And they're necessary here because we really have to confront a massive hurdle for a lot of modern practitioners. You know, you often hear people say they love the psychology of Buddhism, the mindfulness, the ethics.
But they treat the concept of rebirth as just a cultural metaphor, right? Or some antiquated myth that requires blind faith.
Exactly. But Rinpoche, channeling Dignaga and Dharmakirti, flatly rejects that approach. He asserts that rebirth is a logically provable necessity based entirely on the fundamental laws of cause and effect.
And to follow that logic, it demands that we examine the actual nature of consciousness itself. Dignaga and Dharmakirti establish the existence of past and future lives through this really rigorous deduction regarding the mind stream.
How does that deduction work exactly?
Well, a moment of consciousness must be preceded by a substantially concordant cause. So a physical thing matter, like a brain or a body, cannot act as the substantial cause of a non-physical, experiencing phenomenon like consciousness.
Because they're fundamentally different in nature.
Right. Matter can act as a cooperative condition for sure, but only mind can produce mind. So when a person reaches the final moment of death, the physical body is shutting down, the elements are dissolving, but the consciousness is still present.
See, the modern materialistic view assumes that once the brain stops firing, the mind just evaporates into nothingness. You know, the tape recorder is unplugged, so the music stops.
Yeah. But Gillig epistemology argues that this violates the law of causality. At the moment of death, that mental continuum is still heavily saturated with the energetic propulsion of karma and disturbing emotions.
It's like a highly charged stream of energy.
Exactly. It cannot simply vanish without a trace, because causes must produce results. The momentum of that consciousness, propelled by those deeply ingrained emotional imprints, has to produce a subsequent moment of mind.
Right. The energy doesn't just blink out of existence.
No. That subsequent moment of mind, produced by the final moment of the previous life, is the absolute beginning of the next rebirth. Therefore, logically, the continuity of consciousness must persist.
The physical container degrades and goes back to the earth, but the continuum of the mind, driven by its own karmic gravity, just flows into a new physical basis.
Exactly. And once Rinpoche establishes this logical framework, that the mind continues, actions have consequences across lifetimes, and the Buddha is a reliable guide, he shifts to the actual delivery of the teaching in Varanasi.
And the structure the Buddha used to teach the Four Noble Truths is honestly a masterclass in pedagogy. He taught them in three distinct ways, right? By nature, by function, and by the agent's action in the past tense.
Let's break those down. The first way is by nature. This is the act of identification. The Buddha stated, this is true suffering. This is the true origin. This is true cessation. This is the true path.
He's just defining the reality of the situation.
Yes. And Rinpoche adds a really vital clarifier regarding this nature. When the Buddha says, this is true suffering, he's not speaking metaphorically.
Right. To supreme beings, or Aryas, those who have directly non-conceptually realized emptiness, they perceive our contaminated bodies and minds as suffering just as plainly as we perceive a solid table sitting in front of us.
To an Arya, the suffering nature of our existence is an immediate, glaring, objective fact. We're blind to that fact, which is why the Buddha had to articulate it for us.
So once the nature is identified, the teaching moves to the second way, by function. This addresses what the practitioner must actually do with these truths.
Right. The Buddha instructed, suffering is to be understood. The origin is to be abandoned. Cessation is to be attained. The path is to be cultivated.
Which transforms it from abstract philosophy into an immediate action plan. It places the burden of effort entirely on the student. I mean, the Buddha can't understand your suffering for you. He can only point to it.
Exactly. And then the third way is perhaps the most psychologically compelling. The Buddha taught the truths by the agent's action, phrased entirely in the past tense.
Right, like, I have understood suffering. I have abandoned its origin. I have achieved cessation. I have meditated on the path.
Yes. He is demonstrating the completed result. He's standing at the finish line, turning back to his disciples and proving that the method works.
Mm.
And the efficacy of this threefold structure was historical and immediate.
Yeah, upon hearing this very first teaching, the disciple Kandinya attained the state of an arhat, complete liberation, right there in Varanasi.
And the other four disciples present realized selflessness and attained the path of seeing. It was not a theoretical lecture. It was an active transmission that altered their reality on the spot.
Now, as we prepare to look at the specific truths, Rinpoche points out a really fascinating structural choice the Buddha made. If you look at the Four Noble Truths, they're actually presented out of chronological order.
They are. The Buddha taught true suffering first, and its cause, true origin, second. Then he taught true cessation third, and its cause, the true path, fourth.
He presented the results before the causes, but in the actual sequence of reality, the origin creates the suffering. The path creates the cessation. The cause always precedes the effect.
So if the Buddha's logic is so flawless, why reverse the chronological sequence? Rinpoche explains this explicitly through the analogy of a sick person.
Right, because when an illness strikes, you don't experience the microscopic bacteria first. You experience the crushing fatigue, the fever, the pain.
You experience the symptom, the result. Recognizing that you are sick is step one. That is true suffering. Once the pain becomes intolerable, you're driven to seek a diagnosis.
You go to a doctor to find the underlying disease, which is step two, finding the cause or true origin. The teacher is conforming to the psychological experience of the student rather than strict philosophical chronology.
Exactly. And once the doctor diagnoses the disease, they describe the prognosis. They explain what health will look like once the bacteria is eradicated. They paint a picture of a body free from fever. That's step three, true cessation.
Because understanding that a state of absolute health is possible provides the inspiration you need to undergo the treatment.
Right. Only then, with a clear diagnosis and a promise of health, do you actually swallow the bitter medicine. Taking the medicine is step four, practicing the true path.
I think a modern analogy would be someone who is catastrophically in debt. You can't hand a bankrupt person a complex financial restructuring plan, the path, if they're still living in deep denial about their spending.
Oh, they'll just ignore the spreadsheet.
Exactly. You have to force them to sit down, open all the final notices, look at the bottom line of their bank accounts, and fully confront the misery of their bankruptcy. Facing the bankruptcy is the suffering.
And the shock of that pain provides the sheer motivational force required to look honestly at their reckless spending habits, which is the origin.
Yeah. The sequence is a brilliant psychological mechanism designed to generate the urgency required for liberation. These two sets of cause and effect map our entire existence.
The first set, origin causing suffering, details exactly how we circle endlessly in samsara. The second set, the path causing cessation, provides the exact blueprint for our escape.
So you have to begin with the bankruptcy. We have to look at the first noble truth, true suffering, or dukkha satya. And Rinpoche is really uncompromising about what we're actually supposed to recognize here.
He is. Because when we use the English word suffering, our minds habitually default to overt physical agony or severe emotional trauma. We think of a broken leg or the grief of losing a job.
Right, but that is simply the suffering of suffering. And honestly, even animals recognize that and try to avoid it. But Rinpoche points us toward a much deeper, more insidious layer, the suffering of pervasive conditioning.
This requires a radical shift in perspective for most people. The suffering of pervasive conditioning refers to our present body and mind, our physical and mental aggregates, which have been taken under the influence of karma and disturbing emotions.
The very equipment we use to navigate reality is the sickness. Rinpoche uses this amazing analogy of a ringleader in a violent mob.
Right. If a riot is breaking out, the police don't arrest the followers one by one. They identify the ringleader instigating the chaos. If you neutralize the ringleader, the crowd loses its dangerous momentum and disperses.
And our contaminated aggregates are that ringleader. They serve as the magnetic base that attracts and holds all other forms of suffering.
And to ensure we truly comprehend the scope of this sickness, Rinpoche categorizes the myriad manifestations of human suffering. He starts with the fundamental biological sufferings.
Like birth, which is a state of immense physical trauma and constraint. Aging, which is the slow, humiliating decay of our faculties.
Sickness, the constant vulnerability of our physical form. And ultimately death, the violent separation of consciousness from the body.
And then he details the psychological and situational sufferings, like not accomplishing your wishes, pouring your life force into a goal, only to watch it collapse, or separation from loved ones, which is a foundational agony of human attachment.
He also mentions meeting with the unwanted being forced into circumstances or relationships that generate constant friction. And he highlights the suffering of uncertainty.
Oh, the uncertainty. In cyclic existence, there is absolutely no reliability. The person you consider your dearest ally in this lifetime could, through the shifting winds of karma, be born as your bitterest enemy in the next.
There is no solid ground. And crowning all of this is the suffering of unsatisfied craving. No matter how much wealth, status, or sensory pleasure we consume, the mind is structured to acclimate and demand more.
The thirst is fundamentally unquenchable. Now, Rinpoche notes that as heavy as our human suffering feels, it's relatively minor compared to the intense, unmitigated agonies of the lower realms.
But a practitioner might look at their own human life and raise an objection. They might say, well, my life isn't an endless parade of misery. I enjoy good food. I love my family. I experience moments of profound joy.
Right. People always push back on that. But Rinpoche addresses this directly by introducing the concept of contaminated happiness. And during the 1999 retreat, he used this incredibly immediate, visceral example occurring right in the meditation hall.
Yeah. He pointed out that some students had entered the hall feeling cold from the outside weather. When they sat down in the heated room, they experienced a profound sense of relief and happiness. The heat felt good.
But as the teaching progressed, that exact same heat, the very condition that produced their happiness, continued to accumulate. Eventually, they became too hot, began to sweat, and felt increasingly uncomfortable.
The happiness seamlessly transformed into suffering. It was the same heat.
Exactly. Contaminated happiness is nothing more than the temporary alleviation of a previous suffering. You're hungry, which is a suffering. You eat a meal, and the contrast feels like joy.
But if eating was an uncontaminated cause of pure happiness, then eating 10 massive meals in a row would make you 10 times happier. In reality, the third or fourth meal would make you violently ill.
Right. The happiness depends on changing external conditions. Because those conditions are impermanent, and because our aggregates are governed by karma and disturbing emotions, the feeling of happiness is structurally unstable.
It's an anesthetic wearing off, guaranteed to eventually ripen into another form of distress. And to help us penetrate this truth and dismantle our delusions, the Buddha taught four specific attributes of true suffering.
These are basically analytical tools designed to cut through our misperceptions. So the first attribute is impermanence. Meditating deeply on impermanence overcomes our innate, ignorant assumption that our bodies and situations are static.
The second attribute is suffering itself. Recognizing our existence as fundamentally flawed overcomes the deluded habit of viewing our contaminated body and mind as inherently pleasurable or pure.
The third attribute is emptiness. This targets a more subtle philosophical misconception. It means realizing that our aggregates, our physical form, feelings, perceptions, consciousness, are empty of any true independent existence.
They only exist interdependently, relying on a vast web of causes and conditions. And the fourth attribute is selflessness. This strikes at the very core of our delusion, the deeply ingrained belief that there is a self-sufficient, inherently existent self.
Like a concrete eye sitting like a pilot behind our eyes, somehow independent of our changing body and mind. Rinpoche places a massive emphasis on that first attribute, impermanence, because it contains two distinct levels, and the subtle level is the key to realization.
We easily recognize gross impermanence. We see our skin wrinkling over decades. We see a glass fall off a table and shatter. We see the changing of the seasons. These are accessible to our coarse sensory perception.
But the actual target of Buddhist meditation is subtle impermanence, the reality of momentary microscopic change. It's the fact that phenomena are disintegrating and being recreated in every single fraction of an instant.
And our minds are far too coarse to perceive this directly. We look at a table or our own hand and we grasp at it as being the exact same entity today as it was yesterday. It looks solid.
Right. So to force our minds to grasp the terrifying velocity of this constant disintegration, Rinpoche provides the staggering metric. He uses the example of a single finger snap.
Yes. In the tiny fraction of a second it takes to make that sound, Rinpoche states that 65 moments of change have occurred. 65 distinct instances of arising and disintegrating.
Wait, 65 times in one snap?
Yeah, 65 moments of change. The fundamental nature of reality is such that the cause that gives birth to a phenomenon simultaneously acts as the cause for its disintegration. The moment something comes into existence, it is already decaying.
It's in a state of continuous freefall. Internalizing that metric completely dissolves our normal relationship with reality. If you sit quietly and deeply contemplate that the cells in your brain, the chair you're sitting on,
are undergoing complete irreversible transformation 65 times in a single finger snap.
The solid world you cling to begins to look like a mirage. You realize that your existence is a pervasive sickness undergoing relentless, vibrating disintegration. The desperation to hold on to things to protect the self suddenly appears structurally impossible.
When you truly sit with that realization that you are profoundly sick, that your happiness is merely a temporary fluctuation in symptoms, and that your very atoms are vibrating toward their destruction 65 times a second, you are driven to the edge of an existential cliff.
You have to ask, what is generating this relentless, exhausting machine? What is powering the cycle? Which brings us to the doctor's diagnosis of the underlying disease.
We move to the second noble truth, true origin, or samudayasatya. This truth exposes the twin engines that drive the cycle of samsara, karma and the kleshas.
Karma translates simply as action, and the kleshas are the disturbing emotions or mental afflictions. And these two elements don't operate independently, right? They're a symbiotic system.
Exactly. Rinpoche employs a powerful agricultural analogy here. He likens karma to a seed and the disturbing emotions to water and fertilizer.
So if you place a seed in the ground, but deprive it entirely of moisture, that seed will remain dormant indefinitely. It contains the potential for life, but without the cooperative condition of water, it cannot sprout.
Similarly, our mind streams are packed with countless karmic seeds accumulated from beginningless time. Some are seeds of great virtue, Others are seeds of immense suffering. We can't simply reach into the subconscious and extract these seeds.
But those karmic seeds cannot ripen into a future rebirth or a future suffering unless they are continuously watered by the disturbing emotions. It's a terrifying but ultimately empowering framework.
It is, because we can't change the past actions that planted the seeds. But we have total control over the watering can. To stop watering the seeds, we have to identify the fluid.
Right. And the disturbing emotions are numerous and complex. But Rinpoche identifies the three principal kleshas: desire, hatred, and confusion, which is synonymous with ignorance.
And among these three, one sits at the absolute center of the web. Rinpoche uses a political analogy here that perfectly clarifies the hierarchy of our suffering.
Oh, I love this analogy. He compares ignorance to the president sitting securely on a throne in the Capitol. The president rarely gets his hands dirty in the day-to-day skirmishes. He simply holds the fundamental position of authority.
Right. And desire and hatred, conversely, act as the prime minister and the cabinet. They are out in the world reacting to daily situations, passing aggressive legislation, generating active chaos.
But the prime minister only executes the fundamental agenda established by the president. We must define exactly what this ignorance is in this context. It's not a lack of education or a failure to read enough books.
No. Ignorance here is an active, aggressive state of mind. It is the mind grasping at an inherently existent self. It is the visceral feeling of a solid, independent me residing in the center of our experience.
And the moment the mind projects this concrete, independent me that requires protection and validation, it instantly draws a boundary line across the universe. It creates a rigid dichotomy.
If there is a solid me, then everything outside of that boundary becomes other. And that dichotomy is the birthplace of all conflict.
Once the boundary of self and other is established, the reaction is automatic. We generate desperate attachment and desire toward anything, people, possessions, praise, that props up or secures the self.
Simultaneously, we generate aversion, hatred, and fear toward anything in the other category that threatens, frustrates, or diminishes the self.
The self deploys the five sense organs, the eyes, ears, nose, tongue, and body like scouts, sending them out into the dangerous world to scavenge for resources to keep the self happy. Look at this beautiful object. Listen to this validating praise. Taste this rich food.
But because the external world is governed by subtle impermanence, these sensory objects inevitably fail to provide lasting satisfaction. They decay, or our appetite for them morphs into nausea.
And when the objects fail to satisfy, the mind generates profound aversion and anger. Driven by that anger, or driven by unchecked desire, we engage in actions. We speak harsh words to protect our ego. We steal. We harm others.
And through these physical and verbal actions, we create new harmful karma. We plant new seeds in the mind stream. This psychological chain reaction forces us to redefine a word we use all the time. Samsara.
Yeah, people often think of samsara as a place. They think samsara is the stressful city they live in, or the corrupt political system, or the physical planet Earth. They think they can escape samsara by moving to a quiet cabin in the woods.
But Rinpoche clarifies that samsara is not the external environment. The external world is merely the container. Samsara is the contained.
Samsara is our mental and physical aggregates taken under the influence of karma and kleshas. Your body and your conditioned mind are the cyclic existence.
You can take your aggregates to a quiet forest, but the president of ignorance is still sitting on the throne in your mind, generating desire for the silence and aversion toward the mosquitoes.
Exactly. The eye is the agent circling endlessly from one set of aggregates to the next, lifetime after lifetime. And the indestructible thread sewing this miserable tapestry together is karma and the disturbing emotions.
So to understand how to break this thread, we have to look closely at the mechanics of karma. Rinpoche distinguishes between two distinct aspects of any action. First, there is the intention. This is purely mental.
It's the motivation, the specific urge formed in the mind before the body moves or the mouth opens.
Right. Second, there's the intended action, which is the physical or verbal execution of that prior intention. And the intention dictates the karmic weight of the action.
Right. Like you could be walking down the street and accidentally step on an insect. The physical action of killing occurred, but without the mental intention to harm, the karmic imprint is relatively light.
Contrast that with seeing an insect in your house, generating intense aversion toward it, hunting it down with a rolled-up magazine, and purposefully crushing it.
The physical action is the same, but the intention was saturated with hatred. The resulting karmic seed is heavy and dark, and the results of these complete actions are not vague, mystical punishments, Buddhist karma operates as a precise physics of spiritual momentum.
Absolutely. Every complete action produces four distinct types of results. Let's trace a heavy, destructive action like habitual stealing out of deep greed through its four results.
Okay, what's the first one?
First is the ripening result. This is the macro level effect. It determines the actual realm and physical body of your next rebirth. A life dominated by the heavy karma of stealing might ripen as a rebirth in the hungry ghost realm, characterized by unquenchable craving.
Wow. And the second?
Second is the result according with the cause. This dictates behavioral tendencies that carry over into future lives. If you habituate your mind to taking what is not given, the groove in the mind stream is carved deep.
So in a future life, even if born as a human child, you'd have a natural, almost uncontrollable inclination to steal, even if you don't need the object. The behavior perpetuates itself.
Exactly. Third is the experiential result. This affects the specific conditions and quality of your life. The experiential result of past stealing might manifest as living a life where you are constantly impoverished, or where your own possessions are constantly stolen by others.
You experience the exact flavor of the pain you previously inflicted. And finally, the fourth is the environmental result. Our internal karmic state literally shapes the external reality we inhabit.
Right. A mind stream heavily polluted by the karma of theft will be drawn to take rebirth in an environment that is harsh, barren, economically depressed, or plagued by drought. The external container naturally matches the poverty of the internal contained.
It's a closed-loop system of cause and effect. To help us cut through our denial about the origin of our suffering, Rinpoche outlines the four attributes of true origin. The first attribute is simply origin, or cause.
Meditating on this establishes a fierce accountability. It refutes the comforting but false idea that suffering happens randomly or is just bad luck. Karma and kleshas are the definitive, undeniable cause.
The second attribute is origin of all, meaning that every single permutation of suffering, from the grossest agony of the hell realms to the subtle dissatisfaction of a wealthy human, stems from this exact same root.
There is no other source. The third attribute is conditions. This reminds us that the origin acts as the necessary active condition for suffering to grow and manifest. It is the water nourishing the seed.
Without the active condition of the kleshas, the suffering cannot arise. And the fourth attribute is intense production. This emphasizes the sheer, terrifying power of these causes. Ignorance and karma aggressively generate the overwhelming sickness of our existence.
When you look at the architecture of the first two noble truths, a pervasive sickness vibrating into decay 65 times a second, relentlessly driven by an ignorant president generating seeds of future agony that shape our very environment. It's an incredibly bleak assessment.
It really is. If the Buddhist teachings ended with the second noble truth, it would be the most pessimistic, paralyzing philosophy ever articulated. We're bankrupt, the interest is compounding daily, and the system is rigged against us by our own minds.
But this is precisely where the pivot occurs. The depth of the diagnosis exists only to validate the power of the cure. If ignorance is the engine powering samsara, we must remember that an engine is a constructed thing.
It relies on parts. It relies on fuel.
Exactly. And a constructed thing can be dismantled. The wire can be cut. This brings us to the glorious prognosis of perfect health. The third noble truth, true cessation, or Nirodha Satya.
True cessation is the state of liberation, or moksha. Rinpoche defines this state, the state achieved by arhats and fully enlightened Buddhas, as the permanent eradication of suffering from its very root.
It's crucial to understand how radically different this is from the contaminated happiness we discussed earlier.
Yeah.
Contaminated happiness is just taking an aspirin for a brain tumor. The tumor is still there, growing in the dark, and the pain will return.
But true cessation is the complete surgical extraction of the tumor. It's the state of having entirely uprooted the karma and the disturbing emotions. The seeds have been incinerated. The water of the kleshas has been completely evaporated.
Because the causes of suffering have been annihilated, the effect suffering is logically impossible to produce. The mental continuum remains, but it is purified. It is an immaculate, unconditioned state of peace.
It's stable and inexhaustible. It will never, under any circumstances, transform back into suffering. The Buddha laid out four attributes for true cessation to help us understand the magnitude of this health. The first is cessation itself.
Simply affirming the reality that all sufferings, both gross and subtle, have utterly ceased. The second attribute is pacification, or peace. This clarifies that the suffering hasn't just been temporarily suppressed or pushed into the subconscious.
Right. It's been pacified by being completely uprooted from the foundation. The third is excellence, or high auspiciousness. Because the practitioner is entirely free from all suffering and its causes, they remain in a state of supreme, uncontaminated happiness at all times.
They have achieved the ultimate goal of existence. And the fourth attribute is definite emergence. This is the absolute guarantee. It means the suffering will never return.
The freedom achieved is definitive. There's no possibility of falling back into cyclic existence once this state of cessation is actualized. The disease is cured, immunity is absolute, and the patient is free.
Knowing that this perfect health, this definite emergence, is logically possible is profoundly inspiring. The bankrupt person realizes there is a legal, proven mechanism to clear the debt entirely.
But inspiration alone doesn't alter reality. Knowing a cure exists doesn't fix the physical body. The sick patient still needs to walk to the pharmacy, acquire the actual medicine, and commit to swallowing it every single day.
Yes. The diagnosis and the prognosis demand an action plan. This leads us to the fourth noble truth, the true path, or Margasatya. If true cessation is the state of health, the true path is the medicine that produces it.
And Rinpoche defines this medicine with surgical precision. The true path is the wisdom that directly realizes the selflessness of a person.
This wisdom is the direct, targeted antidote to the disease. We established that the root cause of all our suffering, the president sitting on the throne, is ignorance, specifically the mind grasping at an inherently existent solid self.
Right. So if that ignorance is the darkness, the only way to eliminate it is to introduce light. You can't negotiate with the darkness. You must cultivate a wisdom that clearly, experientially sees that such a self absolutely does not exist.
You shine a light into the dark room, and the monster you were terrified of vanishes because it was only a shadow. The medicine is the direct, non-conceptual realization of selflessness.
The four attributes of the true path define how this medicine functions. First is simply path. This indicates that this specific wisdom is the unmistakable, direct vehicle that leads to liberation. It's not a detour, it's the highway.
Second is suitability, sometimes translated as awareness. It means this wisdom is the correct, appropriate method to abandon the disturbing emotions. You wouldn't use a hammer to perform delicate cardiovascular surgery.
Right. Cultivating concentration or practicing temporary suppression are like using a hammer. The wisdom of selflessness is the precise, suitable scalpel required to cut the root of ignorance.
The third attribute is achievement. This refers to the fact that this wisdom directly realizes the actual mode of existence of phenomena. Mm. It sees reality exactly as it is without the distortion of the self-grasping mind.
And the fourth attribute is deliverance. This wisdom acts as the ultimate safeguard, delivering the practitioner from the bondage of cyclic existence and acting as an absolute, impenetrable barrier that prevents suffering from ever taking root again.
Now, as we discuss this profound wisdom realizing selflessness, we really must acknowledge the broader scholarly context. Rinpoche is teaching from the Gelug tradition, and he specifically situates this definition within the Prasenjika Madhyamika view.
This is where the philosophical rigor of the Tibetan tradition reaches its peak. Rinpoche delineates the views of the different Buddhist schools to show the necessary progression of understanding.
Right. The lower philosophical schools assert that realizing the selflessness of persons is sufficient to attain liberation. They argue that if you realize the I does not exist independently of the mental and physical aggregates, if you unmask the solid self, you cut the root of samsara.
You achieve the state of an arhat. You are free from uncontrolled rebirth.
And the lower schools are correct that this cuts the root of samsara. But the Gelug school places the highest emphasis on the Prasenjika Madhyamika, the consequentialist middle way system.
The Prasenjika view asserts that while realizing the selflessness of persons is absolutely necessary to escape samsara, it is not sufficient to attain full, complete Buddhahood.
Exactly. To achieve supreme enlightenment, one must go further. One must realize not only the selflessness of persons, but also the selflessness of phenomena.
So what does that actually mean for the practitioner? The lower schools say, look closely at the self you are trying to protect. You will find it is just an illusion projected onto the body and the mind. Unmask the self.
But the Prasenjika says, yes, unmask the self. But don't stop there. Now look at the body and the mind themselves. Look at the table, the mountain, the concept of time. Unmask the mask.
The Prasenjika system insists that every single phenomenon in the universe is utterly empty of inherent independent existence. Everything exists merely by the power of imputation, dependent on parts, causes, and the mind that labels them.
The consequentialist aspect refers to their method of debate. They draw out the absurd logical consequences of believing that anything has inherent existence.
Like if a table inherently existed from its own side, independent of its parts, you should be able to find the table after you chop the wood into sawdust. But you cannot. Therefore, the table only exists interdependently.
However, despite these profound philosophical distinctions regarding the ultimate nature of phenomena and the final goal of Buddhahood, Rinpoche points out a crucial unifying factor.
All Buddhist schools universally agree on the fundamental mechanism. Ignorance grasping at the self is the root of the disease, and the wisdom realizing emptiness is the only medicine that cures it.
But the practitioner can't just sit down on a cushion, squeeze their eyes shut, and stubbornly demand to realize emptiness. It's not an intellectual puzzle you solve in an afternoon.
No, Rinpoche outlines that achieving this path requires an immense multi-lifetime preparation. To launch a rocket of this magnitude, you need an unfathomable amount of fuel. He details the necessity of the two accumulations.
To achieve the Mahayana path, the practitioner must cultivate both wings of the bird. The first wing is the accumulation of merit.
Merit is the positive karmic energy generated through the vast, sustained practice of the perfections. It requires a radical commitment to ethical discipline, profound generosity, patience in the face of intense provocation, and joyous effort in practice.
This accumulation of merit builds the robust, positive mental infrastructure necessary to support the shattering realization of emptiness. Without immense merit, the mind simply lacks the stability and power to sustain the wisdom.
The second wing is the accumulation of wisdom. This is not passive contemplation. It's active, rigorous, exhausting logical analysis. Rinpoche points out that we must utilize analytical frameworks like contemplating dependent arising or the logic of not one and not many.
We have to intellectually dismantle our solid view of reality. We have to break down our delusions logically before we can ever hope to realize emptiness directly, non-conceptually, in deep placement meditation.
Merit without wisdom might lead to a comfortable, wealthy rebirth, but it will never lead to liberation. Wisdom without merit is dry and lacks the power to transform the deeply ingrained habits of the mind stream. You need both wings to fly.
We have spent this time mapping the philosophy. We've diagnosed the pervasive sickness, identified the origin in karma and kleshas, envisioned the absolute cure of cessation, and formulated the medicine of the true path.
But moving from the lecture hall or the text down to the reality of the meditation cushion is the true test of a practitioner. Rinpoche didn't just leave his students at Buddha House with a notebook full of profound concepts.
No, he concluded the retreat by providing a precise, actionable manual for daily integration.
The first non-negotiable practice point Rinpoche emphasized is the absolute necessity of meditating on the disadvantages of suffering. He invoked the advice of the great master Lama Tsongkhapa.
Tsongkhapa stated unequivocally that without meditating again and again on the faults of suffering, the genuine visceral wish for liberation will never arise in the mind.
We are far too comfortable in our contaminated happiness. We like the heat in the room, even as it makes us sick. Rinpoche used a brilliant analogy of a family dynamic.
He said, imagine you have a severe troublemaker living in your house, someone who is constantly causing chaos, draining the finances, and breaking everyone's heart.
If you refuse to clearly see and acknowledge the faults of that person, if you constantly make excuses for their behavior, you will never summon the resolve to evict them. You will just suffer indefinitely.
And we make excuses for our samsara every single day. We must force ourselves to look directly at the suffering of pervasive conditioning. We must look at the gross and subtle impermanence ravaging our bodies.
We must contemplate the terrifying reality of the lower realms. We have to look the troublemaker directly in the eye. Only when our disgust for cyclic existence becomes genuine and unshakable will the immense energy required to practice the path naturally manifest.
The next crucial practice point is about targeting the enemy. The archer analogy Rinpoche uses here is striking. You can be the strongest person in the world, holding a bow made of the finest materials and chanting the most devout ancient prayers.
But if you're wearing a blindfold, or if you simply don't know where the target is, releasing the arrow is a pointless exercise. You're just shooting blindly into the dark, hoping to hit something.
You must clearly identify the origin of your suffering. You have to know the exact face of the enemy. The enemy is not your difficult boss, your failing physical health, or the political climate. Those are just external conditions.
The actual enemy is internal. It is your own karma, your own kleshas, and specifically the self-grasping ignorance, the president on the throne.
You must use analytical meditation to pinpoint that specific feeling of a solid I in your own mind. Only when the target is clearly locked in your sights do you draw back the bow and release the arrow of the wisdom, realizing emptiness.
And finally, he delivered a very direct instruction to his students sitting in Adelaide in 1999, an instruction that applies equally to you listening to this deep dive right now. He called it the food on the plate analogy.
He told them, do not just hear this teaching, praise how profound it is, and then leave it sitting in the meditation hall. He said, hear the teaching, take it home, meditate on it.
Discuss it with your Dharma community. Clarify your misunderstandings, wrestle with the concepts, and if you have doubts, bring them back to me tomorrow so we can resolve them together.
He emphasized that the Dharma is exactly like a plate of delicious, highly nutritious food set directly in front of a starving person. The food is entirely useless if the person just sits there, admires the presentation, and praises the skill of the chef.
To derive the nourishment, you must pick up the fork, chew the food, and swallow it. You consume the Dharma through two types of meditation. First, analytical meditation thinking through the logic step by step, dismantling your false views.
And second, placement meditation, resting the mind single-pointedly on the conclusion you reached through your analysis. The Dharma requires active, relentless engagement. It is a verb.
As Rinpoche brought that profound 10-session Easter retreat to a close, he engaged in a traditional, incredibly moving practice of aspiration. He dedicated all the positive merit generated by the teachings and the students listening.
And he made a specific vast aspiration prayer. He prayed that all of them, the teacher and the students alike, would be reborn together in the future when Lord Maitreya, the next Buddha of this eon, descends to earth.
He prayed that they would be sitting there in the assembly when Maitreya turns the wheel of the Four Noble Truths for the very first time, just as they had spent the retreat studying Shakyamuni's first turning.
And he prayed that under Maitreya's direct guidance, they might all attain liberation together, exactly like Kondinya and the first five disciples at Varanasi.
It's a stunning vision of spiritual continuity. It connects the historical past of Shakyamuni in India to the 1999 present with Rinpoche in Adelaide, stretching into the vast cosmic future of Maitreya.
It demonstrates that the transmission of these truths is an unbroken, living stream of wisdom.
To recap the ground we've covered, we began by confronting the profound sickness of our conditioned existence, the relentless, vibrating cycle driven by our own karma and disturbing emotions.
We identified the root virus as the ignorance desperately grasping at a solid self. We established through rigorous logic that a complete cure, a permanent cessation of suffering, is not just a myth, but a definite possibility.
And we examined the medicine, the true path of wisdom, realizing emptiness, supported by the twin accumulations of merit and logic. As we close this deep dive into Khyentse Rinpoche's profound instruction, I want to leave you with a final provocative thought, something to actively wrestle with as you step away and re-enter your daily life. I want you to reconsider that metric of subtle impermanence. Listen to the sound.
Just a single snap.
Right now, as you are listening, your physical form, the neurons firing in your brain processing these words, the emotional state you are currently holding, all of it is disintegrating and regenerating 35 times in the space of that single sound.
Everything you consider to be you is in a state of microscopic, unstoppable freefall.
If that is true, and the logic demands that it is, where exactly is the solid, unchanging, permanent you? Where is that concrete self that you are spending all of your time, all of your money, and all of your exhausting emotional energy trying so desperately to protect and satisfy?
If the self is falling apart 65 times a second, what exactly are you defending?
It is the ultimate diagnostic question. We have immense gratitude for Khyentse Rinpoche and the lineage masters who preserved these teachings with such exactitude, and for you taking the time to explore this profound transmission with us. Keep questioning the nature of your reality, keep picking up the fork to consume the Dharma, and we will see you on the next deep dive.